From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When Christiana Northrup found her marriage of 19 years struggling under the weight of three children and a full-time job, she wondered how other people did it, how other couples managed, got along. And so she asked online. She got 70,000 plus responses from all over on love and living, on how people get along. This hour on Point, in the week of Valentine's Day, we're looking at who does what and how it works in relationship. You can join the conversation if you wondered how the rest of the world makes it work on communication, affection, sex, parenting, going the distance. You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Special welcome today to our listeners on the new 92.7 WBUA, Martha's Vineyard, and out on Cape Cod, the islands, and the snowy coast. We are glad you're with us. Joining me now from San Diego, California, is Christiana Northrup. She is co-author of the new book, The Normal Bar, The Surprising Secrets of Happy Couples and What They Reveal About Creating a New Normal in Your Relationship. With the help of Reader's Digest, AOL, The Huffington Post, AARP, and iVillage, she was able to get 70,000 responses to a big online survey about relationships. We'll look at it. Christiana Northrup, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And with us from Seattle, Washington, is Pepper Schwartz. She's one of the country's top thinkers on relationships. She's a professor of sociology at the University of Washington, co-author of The Normal Bar, helped put together the big questionnaire. Pepper Schwartz, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So let's see. Christiana, you had some issues in your relationship. You wanted to know what other people were doing, but so you've got the normal bar. What does that mean, the normal bar?
Well, it's about 14 years in my relationship when I started questioning how happy I was and how happy my husband was. And I created exactly what I was looking for. I wanted to see how I stacked up with my peers and who was doing what and who was doing it right and what I could learn from them and where my expectations were. I was trying to figure out if I was being realistic, wanting more passion and love in my relationship, or we were just at a point that's just, you know, you just have three kids and you work hard and it's just the way it goes. So I started really trying to figure out what's normal and, more importantly, what are the happiest couples doing and what are they doing? What could we learn from them?
So you surveyed 70,000 people, and why not just ask, I don't know, your sister, you know, your mom, the neighbors, the coffee clutch, you know, the folks at the yoga class? I mean, you went out and did it big time. Why?
Well, I wanted more, and I also wanted to see how different incomes, brackets, ethnicities, religions, age, years in a relationship, different cultures. So I wanted to really get a clear idea of all the different facets that feed into the relationship and how they affect the relationship. And I did ask my family and friends, and it's funny when you do that, you either find people that are a lot worse off than you, and then you feel like you're not doing so bad, or, you know, you get even more confused. So having a larger number of respondents and data is the way to go, I felt.
Why look for what's normal, or why even think about it in terms of what's normal? I mean, aren't relationships, in some ways, aren't they all unique, Christiana?
They're very unique, and that's what we found in the data as well. Everybody has is almost a different normal that works for them. But I wanted to know what was working for different people. I wanted to know all about those different unique relationships and what they were doing and what I can change up in my own relationship to make it better.
Pepper Schwartz, help us here with this survey. I mean, internet surveys, you know, our skeptical antenna go up pretty quickly. Maybe they should go up on everything, Kinsey and Masters and Johnson and scientific surveys, all the rest. But can you really put a great big questionnaire online? This one was huge, 1,000-plus questions. People could answer all or just part. Anybody could answer, I guess, anybody who wanted to take the time to do it. Does that really give us a legitimate snapshot of what's going on in relationships?
Well, I think it gives us a good snapshot of people who are interested in relationships. I mean, you know, some people would never do this questionnaire, right? But I think what I do as a sociologist is say, what new information does this give me and what information does it confirm? A lot of our questions had never been asked before, so I couldn't compare them. But we have questions that other people have asked, too. And you see, are we in the ballpark, you know? Are these consistent across other kinds of studies that I've read? So that helps you. I think people are less likely to lie in some of these internet studies because they're totally anonymous. Mm-hmm. We put them into little cubes of questions. You know, you could do this group of sex questions, but if you don't want to talk about sex, you could do the money questions, the family questions, the how do children affect you questions. And that way we thought people didn't start just Xing off boxes that they didn't care about. We tried some really new techniques in this study. We gave people feedback at the end of answering some questions. We had cartoons that you couldn't get to unless you did the questionnaire. We thought, you know, it's a new age. Let's try some new kind of techniques to get people to talk about really important things.
So you asked about
just one study.
Okay. Fair enough. We'll be fairly warned with that. You asked about a lot of things, and you put them then kind of up against the measure of whether people could answer this way or that, but then were they happy in their relationship or unhappy or extremely happy? Did everybody have to tell you whether they were happy, extremely happy, unhappy, or not, Pepper, in this thing?
Yeah, they did, actually. Even if they only did some of the other kinds of questions, we had a core group that you had to answer. Because Chrisiana and our third author, Jim Witte, who's mm-hmm. the statistician and the methodologist of the group, we really wanted to know what made extremely happy, made people extremely happy. Because, you know, a lot of people say they're happy. That's kind of your, you know, default answer. But few people would say, I'm extremely happy. And we wanted to know what was the normal of extremely happy people? Because we felt for sure there'd be lessons for all of us in that.
Chrisiana, so you're married 19 years or so now. It was 14 mm-hmm. then.
Yes.
I guess first question is, did you get around the bend with your partner, your husband? Are you still together?
You know, did we ever? And there was 5 years where we have three kids, and we felt like we were just in survival mode, just barely keeping our head above water. And I felt like over the years, him and I became more and more disconnected. And it's not that either one of us wanted to be with anybody else, but we just couldn't figure out why we weren't feeling fulfilled in our relationship
anymore.
Did this
giant survey help you somehow?
Oh, my gosh. Did it ever?
How? Why? What did you learn that was useful?
Well, I actually moved out before I came up with the whole normal bar concept. So I moved out of the house. We went through probably about 2 years worth of counseling. So we did a ton of counseling. And then the whole concept of the patterns that we set weren't really working for us. And that's when the normal bar kind of arised. And what happened was when Pepper and I put all the questions together and we put it out there, my husband could not wait to talk about the research and the data and what we found out, because we started talking about things that we've never talked about before. And we started implementing things that we were learning from these other couples. And simple changes just absolutely changed our lives. And we fell in love all over again and became best friends. And just everything across the board is better. Our kids are better.
All it took was a global survey.
Oh, it did. It did. And I really hope we help other people, because it's definitely what people need.
So let's start to wade in here. What were some of the findings that you came across in this survey, Chrisiana, that you found most interesting, helpful?
Oh, I love the kissing passionately one. It's one of my favorites. We found that the happiest, extremely, and going back to the extremely, because we had a 7-point scale, the extremely happy couples were still kissing passionately, even 20, 25 years into the relationship plus. And it's something that's very important and very intimate, and it needs to stay in the relationship. And if you're not kissing passionately in your relationship, you need to kind of explore why.
So couples that were happy, were they smooching nonstop? How often were they kissing passionately all day long? What?
A couple times a week, you know. We actually asked the frequency, and it was a normal part of their relationship.
But twice a week? That's kind of rare, doesn't it?
No, gosh, no. If you're in the moment and having any kind of, you know, intimacy, kissing's just it's a wonderful thing. It's very intimate.
But it seems infrequent to me. Only twice a week, a passionate kiss. How passionate? And that's extremely happy.
Yeah, our extremely happy couples are doing it. I think it's 70% of them are.
That's not the only thing they're doing.
Yes, yeah. Give us more,
right.
Pepper. Give us more.
They do a lot of affectionate behaviors. I think one of the things that impressed me the most is how much really happy people call each other by pet names, hold hands, give each other compliments.
Like sweetie pie, honey bunny, all that stuff?
Yes. And you know what? If you start doing that, if you thought it was kind of dumb and to call your partner sweetheart or honey or stuff, put it into the relationship and see if they don't kind of like it. You know, in the beginning, it might be strange, but that little reinforcement of affection was something that extremely happy couples do. And I sure do it more now that I figured that out.
I mean, I think it's great. How much did they do it? All the time? Or what, I don't know. What's the...
Yeah, all the time. And that was actually a really neat data point for me as well, because 14 years in the relationship, I never called my husband anything but his first name, Mark. And when we saw this data...
That's dry. That's dry.
It is. Isn't that horrible? It's horrible. And so... You know, I played a lot of this research into my own relationship and kind of see how it went. And when you call somebody honey, it just starts the conversation better. It's fun.
Kiss them big, hold their hand, and what? Call them honey bunny, call them sweetheart, and you're halfway there. Here's Ingrid Michaelson with Soldier. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
And so it goes, this soldier knows the battle.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a big survey of couples and what it tells us about relationships, what makes them work, what makes them hard, how other people do it. Chrisanna Northrup and Pepper Schwartz are with us. They are co-authors with Jim Witte of the new book, The Normal Bar, The Surprising Secrets of Happy Couples and What They Reveal About Creating a New Normal in Your Relationship. Chrisanna Northrup joins us from San Diego. Pepper Schwartz at the University of Washington is with us from Seattle today. And Pepper, Chrisanna, we've got lots of response here already. Mm-hmm. Karina says, my relationship is my relationship, and I don't really care how it compares to other people's relationships. Each relationship is different. We'll look at that. Laura says, I don't think there is a normal couple, but I like to think the foundation of every couple is respect, understanding, and fun. We'll look at that. And finally, Margie, and this goes to some of your findings, she's been reading what you're selling here. She says 40%, and this is your finding, I guess, 40% say they have sex 3 to 4 times a week. Yeah, right. Either they're lying or have no children, elder parents, pets, or lives. Well, there's a lot to pick up, but let's just go to that one, Chrisanna. What about that, sex and the happy relationship?
Well, I don't think sex is the end-all answer to an extremely happy relationship, but I do think when you are in a better place in your relationship and you're more best friends and you communicate well and just everything's kind of moving along nicely, you do tend to make love a little bit more often, and it's a lot better, and that's what we're looking for, too.
But that's what you think. What's the survey tell us?
That's what the survey tells us, too. That's exactly what the survey tells us. The survey tells us our extremely happy couples are making love 3 to 4 times a week.
Across all ages? Or is that in the honeymoon? Or is that for the distance?
That's in our extremely... So any age, any years in a relationship that said they were extremely happy in a relationship also said they were making love 3 to 4 times a week.
Wow. 27% said a couple times a month. 7.5% said every day. Pepper, you've looked at these issues for a long time. Do these numbers line up with, I don't know, with scientific surveys or with what your experience tells you, Pepper?
I think all the categories are very common in other studies except our 3 to 4 times a week. But nobody else measured extremely happy couples. That's never been done before. So, you know, we don't really know until the study, you know, people who think of themselves that way. My guess, if I broke it down in that categories, you're going to see younger, you're going to see newer. Of course, you know, the time and duration and age, those things make a difference. But when you're really feeling attached, that's one of the ways you show it. I'll tell you, in our unhappy relationships, it's very clear that people are making love very little or, you know, not much compared to the happy one. So while I don't think sex makes a relationship, it's one of those things When you're really happy, it becomes more of a core. If you're not too happy, it becomes a subsidiary. Some happy couples didn't make much love much, but they usually tended to be older. And in fact, usually one of those members is not so satisfied. When we looked at the statistics on how many men would like more sex in their relationship, more than half, way more than half. And some women, too. I mean, it was there was probably 40% of the women who would have liked more. Men would have liked a lot more than the women would. But the fact is that there you are in a monogamous relationship and people feeling they would like more. I mean, I think they could take a clue from happy, extremely happy couples. Not that they have to make love that much, but if they're in that low category of having sex once a month or very rarely, I don't think that's helping anything.
So there's the sex number. They're saying 3 to 4 times a week, 40% saying that's where they are. But communication was the issue that came up number one in the happy couples responses. At least, you know, a lot of people on the web, that's what they say. Chrisanna, tell us about communication. I mean, I guess that's not surprising, but there it is right at the top.
Oh, I love the communication one because throughout the book, the theme was you can really see what all these different people want out of a relationship or expressing what's going on in their own relationship. And going back to the gender difference, men and women, here's men and women who both want more variety also in making love. The numbers were extremely high there. I think it was 78% women wanted more variety, 94% men wanted more variety, but nobody's talking about it. And people are very out of touch, and they assume, they think they know what their partner wants to be happy and what they need from each other. And unless you really sit down and ask your partner, what do you need from me to be happy? And what do you need out of life to be happy? And have that conversation, you'd be surprised how you would know a couple things, but there's a couple things that are really going to surprise you. So there is a big communication gap.
Pepper, what did you see on the communication front in these responses?
I thought it was most fascinating part of our study. First of all, we found that the same-sex couples in our study are probably doing a better job than anyone else. Maybe it helps to be the same sex because you maybe intuit more. But the things that I thought were really interesting is some gender differences about criticism. Two-thirds of men in our study said they felt their women criticized them a lot compared to about half of the women who felt criticized by men. I think a lot of times what we say to somebody like, gee, I don't like the color of that shirt or something, is taken not as helpful, but, you know, maybe a criticism, and depending on the mood of the relationship, maybe even more than that. I think what I see is that people really need to talk about how their partner perceives what they're saying to them, how they're saying it to them. Nobody wants to be perceived as bossy, and I think a lot of people don't realize that they are. People who are really good communicators get all that out. And I think that sometimes they slide more as they get older. One of the things that a little bit worries me in our study, and maybe it's my AARP connection that makes me hone in on this, but when people get older, they've been married for 21 years or more, when their length of the relationship goes on, actually even 6 to 9 years later, a lot of the good stuff starts to attenuate. The feelings that people have that were so glossy in the beginning start not to be as good because people aren't doing all the things they did in the beginning. So I think if people could talk, I mean, it's interesting. 43% of our men and something like 33% of our women told us they keep major secrets from their partners. Now, maybe in some cases that's good, but maybe in some cases communication would bring them closer.
Secrets about what? Do we know?
Oh, yeah, we know.
What is it, Chrisanna?
We actually have a lot of open-ended questions in our interactive survey as well. So we have thousands upon thousands of open-ended answers. And that was one of them. And it really surprised both of us how much people looked at this as almost an outlet. Like, oh, thank goodness I can finally, like, tell somebody this. So yes, when we actually list out a lot of the open-ended answers in the Normal Bar book too, but our it could be anything from hiding money to giving money to kids to having an affair. I mean, there was a pretty wide range of secrets going on.
And what portion of people appear to have major secrets in relationships and in happy relationships?
It was actually in both, if I'm not mistaken. I'm trying to think of the percentage right off the bat. We do have it in the book. But, yeah, extremely happy couples lie as well. And we actually broke it down even more so into what kind of lies were people telling to each other. And from white lies to big lies, one of the lies would be where you're at. And, you know, half the men
like
would...
physically? You mean where I'm calling from right now?
Yes, yes, yes. Like, I'm working late, but then you go and have a beer with your buddy kind of thing. So then that's not a big lie. I mean, you're just... And
GPS will fix that one soon if it hasn't already. I mean, I'm looking at here, Pepper, 27% of happiest couples keeping some secrets. Are secrets, does that mean secrets are not, you know, on their face a problem, Pepper?
Well, yeah. I mean, it depends. You know, in Europe, when we look at France and Italy, it looks like everybody keeps secrets from each other. It's like a way of life. And so the question is, you know, are secrets or lies always destructive? Well, we found that it wasn't always destructive, that the people who did tell secrets and did have lies weren't any less happy than the people who were totally open. So I suppose to some extent it depends what it's about. Like on the little ones, you know, maybe you don't want to tell your partner that they really look lousy today. I mean, maybe they really don't need to hear that and you feel that you haven't told them the truth, but it was in kindness and you don't want to mess them up.
I'm not even sure people would call
that
a secret, you know.
But it's a lie. I mean,
I suppose, but if you said you keep secrets, I don't think that's what people are going to have in mind, right?
Oh, we have two different chapters. Okay. I am confusing you because there is a chapter on lies and there is also stuff on communication and secrets, so they're different. And I agree. But but we still did have, as you said, 27% said they kept major secrets from each other of the happiest couple. And in general, that was 43% of the men and 33% of the women told us. And honestly, some of those secrets that they told us, if they did tell them, that would be that, or they'd be very hard. Like I remember one woman wrote quite poignantly that she has faked orgasms throughout her entire marriage. That's something that's, I think, should be brought up and dealt with, but I can understand, since she's done it so long, how does she broach that? We had people say that they lied early about things about their biography that they were afraid to bring up, like they didn't really have a college degree or, you know, they didn't have the savings they said. I mean, I believe that some of this should get out on the table, but lots of people don't ever do that.
Was that woman in your extremely happy category? Do you recall?
No, she was not.
and if they're communicating so well, if that's part of happiness, what's all the communication about if they have major secrets? You know what I mean?
I think people, our data shows that people think they communicate better than their partner does. You know, their partner doesn't, you know, think they communicate as well as they do. I think people should take this book when they read it and talk about this stuff and see if it opens them up to each other. I think sometimes the communication is at a level that doesn't quite, we have a chapter on trust. And I think a lot of times, you know, people are in a relationship, they feel as close and yet they don't trust each other. And I think sometimes you have to get this stuff out, handle it, and then you could feel like you could trust that person because you've given them very vulnerable things. You've asked them to know the real you, and that's what intimacy is to me.
Let's get a call from Alex in Nashville, Tennessee. Alex, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I was just wondering if with some of these things we're saying makes couples extremely happy, if we're maybe confusing correlation and causation. Maybe they're doing these things because they're extremely happy, like the pet names and the kissing and stuff, rather than the other way around.
It's a great question. I'll bring it to both. But, well, Chrisanna, I'll come first to you. I mean, Pepper's our sociologist, but you've been thinking about this. You know, are you going to be kissy face and holding hands because it rocks? Or can you do those things and make it rock?
Well, the neat thing about the Normal Bar book is that we actually really, really break it down. And we don't advocate to be normal. We just show what is normal. And it's really up to you to kind of figure out kind of where you are in your own relationship and kind of look at what other people are doing. And it's almost like building blocks. It just doesn't happen overnight. You know, I'm not going to, you know, when I first started doing this, say, you know, hey, Mark, we need to start calling each other pet names and kissing more. It does not work that way. You got to kind of, one of the things that we really talk about is becoming connected again. So it's almost like you got to start with why are you feeling disconnected in the relationship, and kind of build from there. And we that's exactly what we do throughout the book, is more build on top of each other. So,
Pepper, what about this, correlation or causation? Alex is, I think, raising a good question there.
Alex is a good sociologist. Everybody should ask that question. And I think it's both sometimes. You know, I mean, obviously, happy couples are, you know, have a sort of more arrows in their quiver. They just do. But I've also seen things that actually have an impact that wasn't coming from the relationship. Let me take a simple one like handholding, which is one that I actually had to learn. And it was sort of interesting to see it come up in our data. That is to say, if you hold hands while having an argument, easy to hold hands when you're walking down the street. It just expresses how you're feeling. But let's say you're having an argument and you've read this from us or someplace else, and you say, okay, let's hold hands while we talk about something difficult.
Well, that's a high bar right there.
Okay. But let's try it, right? Let's just try it. And you will find immediately you calm down. You're joined in the argument. It's about the problem and not each other. It literally has both a physiological and emotional impact that wasn't there when you started. So it's a small example, but I'd say we have some things that we can see change things, and other things were changed by the mood of the relationship and how you feel about each other.
Boy, for people who don't hold hands, that's a hard place to begin, I think, in the middle of the throwdown.
No, what you do is you say, okay, when we argue, We in the back of every chapter, we have some very simple suggestions, because we think very simple suggestions work and nobody's going to do anything too complex anyhow. So one of them is, okay, we have a tough discussion going on. We're going to have this. And I've done this myself, by the way.
Yeah.
Where this is going to be really tough. We're going to start holding hands and we're not going to let go, and we're going to resolve it under these circumstances. This is the deal we make to each other.
Well, great,
and
if you can do
me,
it. I think I'd rather do it out on the boardwalk or under the stars when things are really sweet, or just all the time. But okay. There's a brave prescription. Chris Anna, have you tried that one in the middle of the tiff?
I mean, I have to say, since my husband and I kind of got back together, we really have not had a big argument since we looked at the study and put different things into place. So we have not been there yet. So far, so good.
Great. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Here's Howie Day with Collide. We'll be right back.
Even the best fall down sometimes. Even the wrong words seem to rhyme. Out of the doubt that fills your mind, you finally find you and I collide.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a big survey of couples and what it tells us about relationship, what makes them work, what makes them difficult, how other people do it. Chrisanna Northrup and Pepper Schwartz are here from San Diego and Seattle, co-authors with Jim Witte of The Normal Bar. And they've got all kinds of numbers from an enormous online survey. Make of that what you will, but a lot of people responded to it, 70,000 plus all over the world. All kinds of comments online. You guys say sex 3 to 4 times a week and happy couples. Renato says 3 to 4 times a week with each other or in general? We'll look at fidelity issues. AC says, I've been with my husband since I was 16. People think we're weird. Hey, AC, I've been with my gal since we were 16, and she absolutely rocks my world. I don't think that's weird. We honey bunny it to the max. let's go to our listeners. Tracy in Richmond, Virginia. Tracy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My comment goes to causality with your previous caller as well. Mm-hmm. We know scientifically that close intimate contact between two people produces more bonding hormones like oxytocin. And so I would put forth that those extremely happy couples get some of that extreme happiness from more frequent contact physically.
So are you talking hand-holding, or are you talking sex? What qualifies for you, Tracy?
Well, from the research, it's sex. It's skin-to-skin contact. Good skin-to-skin contact generates those hormones and helps you bond with your partner.
And I guess you're going to get the most of all right there. This brings us back to Alex in Nashville's question of causation and correlation, Pepper. What about, you know, sex as an outcome of a happy relationship? Sex is almost a biological encourager of a good relationship.
But you can be both. You know, that is to say, it is an expression of love and closeness, but also if you act as if, in other words, you say, oh, I'm not so much in the mood, but, you know, let's stroke, touch, kiss, whatever each other. Suddenly, as I totally agree with the caller. Those hormones get going. Oxytocin happens if, in fact, it goes all the way to intense intimacy mm-hmm. of various kinds. That is a kind of a bliss hormone, which then creates more closeness, which then creates more touching and sexuality. You're in a loop. They're not so distinctly different from each other. They create each other.
Can I ask, here's Maggie who writes at the website, she's talking about her relationship, and she says, we are compatible in every way I can think of. Every way I can think of, and have been together for 13 years. The only thing is we're not compatible sexually. How common is a sexless marriage? We soothe and kiss and touch each other, never even had a fight. But sex just isn't the heart of it. How common did you find that, Chrisanna, in your survey?
Well, mine was more in the relationship. I just, you know, we were going through the motions.
The survey, Chrisanna.
Oh, sorry. Sorry.
Good for you and Mark, but we want to know about 70,000 people around the world and sexless relationships.
Yeah, I'm gonna give you, Pepper, Chris, that. Yeah, Pepper is more the sex expert on this one.
Pepper, tell us.
You know, our own study and some other studies have said that maybe 15 to 20% of couples have little or no sex. So that's a reality, I think. Now the question is, how often is that with a happy relationship? Rare. Extremely happy relationship? Extremely rare. Because you've got to have two people that say that's okay, and usually one person doesn't think that's okay. It turns into not a best friend situation, but a good friend, a teammate, you know, a kind of good feeling about each other, but not that passion, and that doesn't correlate with extreme happiness. There are people, if they both have sex as a very low need, they can be happy, but they're rare.
But yet, you know, you're sympathetic to Maggie. I mean, I don't know who wants what in her relationship, but compatible in every way she can think of, and together for a pretty good stretch there, that's nothing to sneeze at.
It's up to her. Nobody, yeah. I'm never, ever going to tell anyone to be happy in my terms. I tell you what the data shows, but that those are all statistics. Every individual finds a way to craft their own relationship. What they have to be honest is, are they fulfilled and happy? If they're fulfilled and happy, do what you're doing. If you're not fulfilled and you're not happy, then think about what other normal is out there.
I was struck in the survey, 44% of men and 29% of women say it bothers them a lot that their partner is not more romantic. Chrisanna, more men than women bothered by that.
Yes, yes. It's a great voice for men. Pepper and I are both shocked by that as well. And it was, you know, both men and women wanted more romance, but it really, the question was, does it bother you a lot that you're not getting enough romance? And men feel a little bit cheated, according to our survey. They feel that they want a little bit of romance in the relationship too.
What do you make of that, Pepper?
I think it's true. I've seen a lot of other studies where it indicates that men are actually more romantic than women in many ways. I was touched by these statistics. I think it would be so easy for everyone to inject more romanticism. And I'll tell you, they should do it. While some couples will just settle and say, you know, okay, you know, we have a whole chapter on temptations. And one of the interesting things, the statistics I saw in that was 61% of our women and 90% of the men fantasize sexually about people they meet. And I think some of that sexuality is actually hankering for more attention and more romance. It may come out in terms of sexual fantasy, but I just think if you inject enough romance and affection and, you know, a certain level of sexuality, you know, what you're doing is you're shoring up a relationship that you care about. One of the statistics I found most shocking was how often even our most extremely happy couples had considered breaking up. I think you know, life is long and relationships have lots and lots of challenges and you need to build them to be as strong as they can be.
That is interesting. What kind of portion do you recall offhand? Was it a significant proportion of extremely happy couples who thought of breaking up?
Oh, yeah, it was. I'm trying to think of the exact
I think it was around a quarter of them.
So what does that say to you? I mean, they thought of, is that just human? That's just the way it is, but there's something in their relationship that's worth coming back to? Or is it, do they just happen to be people who are, you know, that's the cut of their jib. They're like loyalty prone.
Well, I think that's true. There are loyalty. There are people who will never leave a relationship, who maybe should. We've all known some of those relationships. But I think there is also the situation where any marriage can create or be caught in a situation of great challenge, whether it's an affair by the other person, whether it's a loss of a job, whether it's depression, whether it's something about the person that you didn't expect. And many, many people meet that challenge and go on to be happy and are happy when they talk to us. So I don't think it's shocking that some of these happy couples have considered breaking up. Who knows what they had to get over in the
I mean, we have human minds. They think about everything, don't they? I mean, human minds are all over the place. We can imagine anything.
Oh, absolutely. And we are a physical presence too. We react to people out there. One of our little hints is never let your partner go to a school reunion alone.
well, what about that? Renato asked about the 3 to 4 times a week and said with each other. What about fidelity and infidelity? What kind of numbers did you find?
Well, we found numbers that I think were pretty current to a lot of others. I think we found that probably only about 15% of people overall said they'd had an affair. Slightly larger numbers when you talked about just infidelity, you know, just having sex with somebody. That got up to a quarter in some groups, a third in some others. I think that's not unlike what other people have found.
What about happy couples?
Oh, well, just of the happy couples. It's, you know, as you would imagine, it's lower for them, much lower. But I can't remember right off the tip of my mind what it was.
Right. We've got questions here about money, questions about space. Sam asked about how much personal space people need. I don't know if you got right down to square footage in the house, in the casa, or money. What about money and its significance? Does it seem to correlate, did people say, with marital happiness, Chrisanna?
I love the money one because we asked that one question. If you could have anything in the world, what would it be? And we had a long list of answers. And people chose money over health, which it was just shocking to me that people would rather have money than their own health. We have a whole
chapter. I think
chapter.
They haven't experienced ill health in that case.
Yeah, yes, no kidding. Exactly. But we have a whole chapter about money and happiness and does money create happiness. And we did find that money does not create happiness, that our larger income brackets actually argue more than everyone else. So we have a whole chapter about, you know, how people split their money, who keeps their money together, how that makes a difference. A lot of people don't talk about how much money they make, but we did find that our extremely happy couples do talk about money more and talk about how much money they make. And a large number keep separate accounts, even over the years, you know, keep money combined in separate accounts. We also found that even though you make more money and maybe your partner stays home, that it was nice to see that there was almost equal, you both equally built into the relationship, you know, financially what you wanted and so forth. It wasn't the person that made all the money. So it was some really great stats on money.
Pepper, we'd like to think, we absolutely love to believe that money doesn't matter, but we know hard times are hard. What do you see in the numbers there?
Well, it was really interesting to me was the couples that argued the most about money were the middle class. People who were really had very tight incomes, under 20,000, didn't have a lot of arguments. I think they just didn't have a lot of leeway in how they were going to spend it or, you know, impossible to save it, et cetera. More arguments about money when people earn $250,000 or more. We're going like, what's there to argue about? You
well,
know,
I guess there's more to argue about. Is it going to be a yacht or a summer house?
I guess, but there was a lot of conflict. So you thought, well, okay, it's not how much money you have. I guess it's, you know, how much your values and what you want to do with that money sync up, and whether you use money for control or whether you just use it as money, who knows? It's always an issue. It didn't surface as the biggest issue for men. Of the things that people, of the gender differences I found interesting, women, the third highest thing they talked about that they wanted in a relationship was financial stability. So I think there's a difference, you know, with how much and whether or not you feel safe.
Yeah, yeah. Let's go to Nicole in Gesney, South Carolina. Nicole, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm wondering about the similarities in relationships siblings might have with their significant others, if possibly their genetics or upbringings have something to do with that.
That's interesting. Does success... sorry, Nicole, tell us.
Okay, I have stepbrothers who have somewhat grown up in different situations, yet we have really similar issues or happiness with relationships.
I don't know if we can find that from an online survey where everybody tosses in their individual response, but we'll ask Pepper Schwartz, does success or its opposite run in families, run among siblings?
Well, we used to have data, not from this study, because we don't know that. I think it's a really fascinating question, to tell you the truth. But from other studies, there does seem to be some similarity depending on the parents' relationship. You know, whether they got divorced or not, whether they are high conflict, those things do affect children. But they can often affect siblings differently because, as you kind of know, every sibling has their own relationship with their child and, excuse me, with their parents. And it kind of depends on who the parents were when that child came into the world. They change over the life cycle, too. So I wish we had more on that in our study because I do think it's an important impact.
So here we are. We've got the whole world responding here. Were there significant differences between, on any of these vectors, between Americans and others? Chrisanna, Pepper?
Yeah, well, actually there was yes. Quite a bit.
You had 23,000 Americans responding. You had 75,000 responses. That means you've got a lot of global response. What were some of the things that set the American respondents apart or others apart from us?
Well, we've mentioned a few. I mean, the Latin American countries, you know, they talk about Latin lovers. Well, they're right. They really are. Particularly Spain kept coming up. We had all our questionnaires translated into local languages so people could answer these in their own language. And Spain, France, Italy, you know, they were always in front of us. And we were always in front
of what exactly?
Asian countries.
Time in the sack or just romance or expressions of passion or what?
Yes.
All of the above. Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
You know, and it was sort of like, you know, the Latin and the romance countries on the top, we're sort of below that. You know, England, Canada, a little bit below us, the Asian countries below that. On all those items, there were some interesting data.
But happiness, I think I saw some of them below the U.S., Chrisanna, when it came to just happy relationships.
Yes, there were a couple that were... just trying to find that data right off the bat.
I mean, the French, you know, well, they go out on dates more than us. The 55% hardly ever go out on a date, these couples. Italians, 53. The U.S. was better on both of those counts. I don't know if that made them more happy, but at least they were going out.
Well, the dates definitely filtered into our extremely happy couples. And we found also with romantic getaways and vacations, very, very, very important for couples to find somebody to take care of the kids either for a night or for a weekend if they have kids, and if they don't, just to get away for a couple of days or a week. Definitely in the U.S., we need to see more people vacationing together without the kids.
Well,
oh, my goodness. You know, the French take, you know, basically a summer off to be with each other, and we had more than almost three-quarters of Americans have not taken a romantic vacation together. I mean, that can't be good.
Though money may come in there just a little bit. Though, what, hop in the car, make that vacation wherever you can find it. People responding in all kinds of ways here. Everybody's curious about what an internet survey really tells us. Let's pay more attention to that. Drew says, holding hands in an argument, well, it prevents your partner from smacking you. I hope that's a gentle smack we're talking about. There's some advice right there. Chrisanna Northrup, Pepper Schwartz, co-authors of The Normal Bar. We're really happy to have you with us this hour. Thank you so much for all of your work. Good luck with your relationship there, Chrisanna.
Thanks.
And Pepper, great to have you back with us. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Listeners, thanks for your questions and your comments, some really funny ones here. Tomorrow, we talk with Lawrence Wright, Pulitzer Prize winner, about the world of Scientology behind closed doors. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.